Sounds True and Shambhala Lion Editions present A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber, Session 4, From a Global View.
Now, we were discussing the interior transformations that occur on the way to the global and all of the problems that can prevent the emergence of this global awareness.
That's right. And we had reached the point where there's a paradigm shift from pre-conventional to conventional, or pre-personal to personal modes of awareness, from Fulcrum 3 to Fulcrum 4, which is especially evidenced in the capacity to take the role of other. And in this shift, we see a continuing decrease in egocentrism. In fact, the overall direction of development in humans, the telos of human development, is toward less and less egocentric states. But this is true in general. The arch battle in the universe is always evolution versus egocentrism. The evolutionary drive to produce greater depth is synonymous with the drive to overcome egocentrism, to find wider and deeper holes, to unfold greater and greater unions. A molecule overcomes the egocentrism of an atom. A cell overcomes the egocentrism of a molecule. And nowhere is this trend more obvious than in human development itself.
So one way of looking at evolution is that it's a continual decline in egocentrism.
That's right, yes, a continual decentering. Howard Gardner gives a perfect summary of the research in this area, and I want to read a short quote from him because it pretty much says it all. He begins by pointing out that development in general is marked by, quote, the decline of egocentrism, unquote. He reports, quote again, the young child is totally egocentric, meaning not that he thinks selfishly only about himself, but to the contrary, that he is incapable of thinking about himself. The egocentric child is unable to differentiate himself from the rest of the world. He hasn't separated himself out from others or from objects. Thus he feels that others share his pain or his pleasure, that his mumblings will inevitably be understood, that his perspective is shared by all persons, that even animals and plants partake of his consciousness. In playing hide-and-seek, he will hide in broad view of other persons because his egocentrism prevents him from recognizing that others are aware of his location. The whole course of human development can be viewed as a continuing decline in egocentrism. End quote.
So egocentrism, or narcissism, is greatest at Fulcrum 1 and then steadily declines?
Yes, exactly. Because at Fulcrum 1, differentiation is at its least. Narcissism is at its worst. This self-centrism lessens somewhat as the infant's identity switches from physiocentric to biocentric, from Fulcrum 1 to Fulcrum 2, that is. The child does not treat the physical world as an extension of itself because physical self and physical world are now differentiated. But the emotional self and the emotional world are not yet differentiated, and so the entire emotional world is an extension of the self. Emotional narcissism is at its peak. The biocentric or ecological self of Fulcrum 2 is thus still profoundly egocentric. What it's feeling, the world is feeling. This narcissism is lessened or declines once again with the emergence of the conceptual self, that's Fulcrum 3. The self is now a conceptual ego, but that ego still cannot yet take the role of other. So the early ego is still largely narcissistic, pre-conventional, egocentric. This declining narcissism can be summarized as going from physiocentric to biocentric to egocentric. All three are egocentric in the general sense, but less and less so. And the whole egocentric perspective undergoes yet another radical shift with the emergence of the capacity to take the role of other, at which point egocentric shifts to sociocentric.
In other words, Fulcrum 4.
That's right. At this stage, what becomes crucially important for me is not how I fit with my biological impulses, but how I fit with my social roles, my group, my peer group, or, a bit wider, how I fit with my country, my state, my people. I'm now taking the role of other, and how I fit with the other is crucially important. I have decentered once again, differentiated once again, transcended once again. My ego is not the only ego in the universe. So this sociocentric stance is a major transformation or paradigm shift from the previous and especially egocentric stances of the first three fulcrums. But notice, with fulcrum four, care and concern are expanded from me to the group, but no further. If you are a member of the group, a member of my tribe, my mythology, my ideology, then you are saved as well. But if you belong to a different culture, a different group, a different mythology, a different god, then you're damned. So this sociocentric or conventional stance tends to be very ethnocentric. Care and concern are expanded from me to my group, and there it stops. So I also call this conventional or sociocentric stance by the term mythic membership. The worldview of Fulcrum 4 is still mythological, and so care and concern are extended to believers in the same mythology, the same ideology, the same race, the same creed, the same culture, but no further. If you're a member of the myth, you are my brother, my sister. If not, you go to hell. In other words, I can decenter from my ego to my group, but I cannot yet decenter my group. My group is the only group in the universe. I cannot yet move from sociocentric and ethnocentric to a truly world-centric or universal or global stance, a decentered universal pluralistic stance. But I am getting there, slowly. I am on the way to global, with each stage in this journey marked by a profound decentering, a lessening of egocentrism, a lessening of narcissism, a transcendence of the shallower, and a disclosure of the deeper. Decentering, transcendence, decreasing egocentrism. So many words for the same thing, the same telos of evolution. And, in fact, the post-conventional or global or world-centric stance is the next fulcrum, Fulcrum 5.
And what's new about Fulcrum 5?
Well, around the age of 11 to 15 years in our culture, the capacity for formal operational awareness emerges. Where concrete operational awareness can operate on the concrete world, formal operational awareness can operate on thought itself. It's not just thinking about the world, it's thinking about thinking. There's also a classical experiment that Piaget used to spot this extremely important emergence or paradigm shift or worldview shift. In simplified version, the person is given three glasses of clear liquid and told that they can be mixed in a way that will produce a yellow color. The person is then asked to produce the yellow color. Concrete operational children will simply start mixing the liquids together haphazardly. They'll keep doing this until they stumble on the right combination or give up. In other words, as the name implies, they perform concrete operations. They have to actually do it in a concrete way. Formal operational adolescents will first form a general picture of the fact that you have to try glass A with glass B, then A with C, then B with C, and so on. If you ask them about it, they'll say something like, "Well, I need to try all the various combinations one at a time." In other words, they have a formal operation in their mind, a scheme that lets them know that you have to try all the possible combinations.
That still sounds pretty dry and abstract.
Well, functionally, it means the person can begin to imagine different possible worlds. What if and as if can be grasped for the first time, and this ushers the person into the wild world of the true dreamer. All sorts of idealistic possibilities open up, and the person's awareness can dream of things that are not yet, and picture future worlds of ideal possibilities, and work to change the world according to those dreams. You can imagine what yet might be. Adolescence is such a wild time, not just because of sexual blossoming, but because possible worlds open up to the mind's eye. It's the age of reason and revolution. Likewise, thinking about thought means true introspection becomes possible. The interior world, for the first time, opens up before the mind's eye. Psychological space becomes a new and exciting terrain. Inward visions dance in the head, and for the first time, they're not coming from external nature, nor from a mythic god, nor from a conventional other, but in some strange and miraculous way, they come from a voice within. And this means one other very important thing. Because you can think about thinking, you can start to judge the roles and the rules which at the previous stage you simply swallowed unreflexively. Your moral stance moves from conventional to post-conventional. You can criticize your own conventional society. Because you can think about thought, you can norm the norms. You might end up agreeing with the norms, or you might disagree with them, but the point is, you can scrutinize many of them. You're no longer merely identified with them, and so you have some critical distance from them. To some degree, you've transcended them. This, of course, is the 1-2-3 process as it moves from fulcrum 4 to fulcrum 5. You start out at fulcrum 4 in fusion with the conventional roles and rules. You're identified with them, merged with them, and thus utterly at their mercy, a true conformist. Then you begin to differentiate or transcend them, gain some freedom from them, and move to the next higher stage, that's fulcrum 5, whereupon you will still have to integrate these social roles. You can still be a father without being lost in that role. But you have in general moved away from, or differentiated from, an exclusive identity with your sociocentric roles, and you particularly begin to scrutinize the rightness or appropriateness of your sociocentric and ethnocentric perspectives, which previously you would not, and could not, even question. In short, you've gone from sociocentric to world-centric. Another decline in narcissism. Another decentering, another transcendence. You want to know what's right and fair, not just for you and your people, but for all peoples. You take a post-conventional or global or world-centric stance. So in this transformation from sociocentric to world-centric, the self decenters once again. My group is not the only group in the universe. My tribe is not the only tribe. My God is not the only God. My ideology is not the only ideology. I went from egocentric to ethnocentric by decentering my ego into the group. Now I go from ethnocentric to world-centric by decentering my group into the world. This is a very difficult transformation, but when it succeeds, which is fairly rare, greater depth, less span, then we have the first truly universal or global or world-centric stance. For the very first time in all of consciousness development and evolution, we have a world-centric and global perspective. And just as important, all further and higher developments will have this world-centric platform as their base. It is an irreversible shift. Once you see the world in global perspectives, you can't prevent yourself from doing so. You can never go back. And the spirit has, for the first time in evolution, look through your eyes and seen a global world, a world that is decentered from the me and the mine, a world that demands care and concern and compassion and conviction, a spirit that is unfolding its own intrinsic value and worth, but a spirit that announces itself only through the voice of those who have the courage to stand in the world-centric space and defend it against lesser and shallower engagements.
Which brings us to the last major orthodox or conventional stage, or the highest stage most conventional researchers tend to recognize.
Yes, that's right, fulcrum 6. The basic structure at this stage is vision logic. Vision logic, or network logic, is a type of synthesizing and integrating awareness. Formal operational awareness is synthesizing and integrating in many important and impressive ways, but it still tends to possess a kind of dichotomizing logic, a logic of either-or, rather like Aristotelian logic. But vision logic adds up the parts and sees networks of interactions. When employed in a merely objectifying or right-hand fashion, it produces objective systems theory in general. But when it is the basis of actual interior transformation, which is not covered by systems theory, and which is very rare, then it supports an integrated personality. When the self-center of gravity identifies with vision logic, when the person lives from that level, then we tend to get a very highly integrated personality, a self that can actually inhabit a global perspective. So the highly integrative capacity of vision logic supports an equally integrated self, which is why I call the self of this stage the centaur, representing an integration of the mind and the body, the noosphere and the biosphere, in a relatively autonomous self, which doesn't mean isolated self or atomistic self or egocentric self, but rather a self integrated in its networks of responsibility and service. Several researchers have looked at this stage very carefully, Lovinger, Selman, Habermas, Erickson, Graves, and Maslow, for example. I've always appreciated the summary of John Broughton's research, which illustrates this stage well. Quote, "Mind and body are both experiences of an integrated self," unquote. That says it all in a very succinct fashion. First of all, the self at this stage is aware of both the mind and the body as experiences. That is, the observing self is beginning to transcend both the mind and the body, and thus can be aware of them as objects in awareness, as experiences. It's not just the mind looking at the world. It is the observing self looking at both the mind and the world. This is a very powerful transcendence, which we will see intensify in the higher stages. And second, precisely because the observing self is beginning to transcend the mind and the body, it can for just that reason begin to integrate the mind and body, which is why I refer to this stage as the centauric stage, that of the centaur. So in this fulcrum, we have the same 1-2-3 process that we see in every other fulcrum, namely initial fusion, differentiation, and integration. In this case, there's the initial identification with the formal mind of fulcrum 5. The observing self then begins to differentiate from the mind and to see it as an object. Since it's no longer exclusively identified with the mind, it can integrate the mind with the other components in awareness, with the body and its impulses. Hence, centaur, mind and body, are both experiences of an integrated self.
You also call the centauric level, this vision logic stage, the existential level. Can you say something about that?
Well, at this stage, you're really, as it were, on your own, at least at this point in evolution. You no longer have blind faith in the conventional roles and rules of society. You're no longer ethnocentric and sociocentric. You've moved deeply into a world-centric space where you can slip and take a very bad spill in this new freedom.
Now, you call this new freedom, unique to this stage of development, aperspectival.
Jean Gebser's term, yes. Vision logic adds up all the different perspectives, and therefore it doesn't automatically privilege any one perspective over the others. It is aperspectival. But as you begin to take all the different perspectives into account, it gets quite overwhelming, very aperspectival, very disorienting. And you can get very lost in this new aperspectival awareness of vision logic, because all perspectives start to become relative and interdependent. There is nothing absolutely foundational, no final place to rest your head and say, "I've got it." The fact that all perspectives are relative does not mean that all perspectives are equal. That all perspectives are relative does not prevent some from being relatively better than others all the time. World-centric is better than ethnocentric, is better than egocentric, because each has more depth than its shallower predecessors. But forgetting that, and focusing merely on the relativity of perspectives, throws you into a perspectival madness, a dizzifying paralysis of will and judgment. It's all relative, so there's no better and worse, and no stance is better than another. Overlooking the fact that that stance itself claims to be better than the alternatives, the standard performative contradiction. The aperspectival space of vision logic simply means that spirit is looking at the world through infinitely wondrous perspectives. It does not mean it has gone blind in the process. This is simply a further decentering, a further transcendence, another spiral in the evolution beyond egocentrism.
So this further decentering, that's part of the good news of this existential or centauric stage of vision logic, yeah?
Mm-hmm. One of the characteristics of the actual self of this stage, the centaur, is precisely that it no longer buys all the conventional and numbing consolations. As Kierkegaard put it, the self can no longer tranquilize itself with the trivial. The emergence of this more authentic or existential self is the primary task of Fulcrum 6. The finite self is going to die. Magic will not save it. Mythic gods will not save it. Rational science will not save it. And facing that cutting fact is part of becoming authentic. This was one of Heidegger's constant points, coming to terms with one's mortality and one's finitude. This is part of finding one's own authentic being in the world, what I call authentic agency and communion. The existentialists have beautifully analyzed this authentic self, the actual centauric self, its characteristics, its mode of being, its stance in the world, and most important, they've analyzed the common lies and bad faith that sabotage this authenticity. We lie about our mortality and finitude by constructing immortality symbols, vain attempts to beat time and exist everlastingly in some mythic heaven, some rational project, some great artwork, through which we project our incapacity to face death. We lie about the responsibility for our own choices, preferring to see ourselves as passive victims of some outside force. We lie about the richness of the present by projecting ourselves backward in guilt and forward in anxiety. We lie about our fundamental responsibility by hiding in the herd mentality, getting lost in the other. In place of the authentic or actual self, we live as the inauthentic self, the false self, fashioning its projects of deception to hide itself from the shocking truth of existence. I fully agree with all of that analysis, as far as it goes, because, from my own point of view, not only is this type of existential authenticity important for its own sake, it's a prerequisite for entering the transpersonal, not burdened with myths or magical expectations or egocentric and ethnocentric exaltations.
And yet there's such a fatalistic tone among these existential writers.
Well, yes, this is classically the tone of existential dread, despair, angst, fear and trembling, sickness unto death, precisely because you've lost all the comforting consolations. All of which is true enough, but because the existentialists recognize no sphere of consciousness higher than this, they're stuck with the existential worldview, which limits their perceptions to within its horizon. So they make it something of a point of honor to embrace drab existential nightmares with dreadful seriousness. And if you claim there are any modes of awareness that go beyond existential angst, then you must be lapsing into death denial, immortality projects, inauthenticity, bad faith. The whole point of the existential level is that you are not yet in the transpersonal, but you are no longer totally anchored in the personal. The whole personal domain has started to lose its flavor, has started to become profoundly meaningless. And so, of course, there's not much reason to smile. What good is the personal anyway? It's just going to die. Why even inhabit it? This concern with meaning and with its pervasive lack is perhaps the central feature of Fulcrum's six pathologies and with existential therapy. But the interesting point is that the centaur, by all orthodox standards, ought to be happy and full and joyous. After all, it's an integrated and autonomous self. Why, by all standards, this self ought to be smiling all the time. But more often than not, it is not smiling. It is profoundly unhappy. It is integrated and autonomous and miserable. It has tasted everything that the personal realm can offer, and it's not enough. The world has started to go flat in its appeal. No experience tastes good anymore. Nothing satisfies anymore. Nothing is worth pursuing anymore. Not because one has failed to get these rewards, but precisely because one has achieved them royally, tasted it all, and found it all lacking. This is a soul for whom all desires have become thin and pale and anemic. This is a soul who, in facing existence squarely, is thoroughly sick of it. This is a soul for whom the personal has gone totally flat. This is, in other words, a soul on the brink of the transpersonal.
Let's move now into the transpersonal stages, the superconscious domains. We left off development at the centauric stage of development, or the vision logic level, and you described this as the observing self becoming aware of both mind and body, and thus beginning to transcend them.
Yes, even orthodox research confirms this. By the time of the centaur, the observing self can witness or experience both the mind and the body in a general sense, which means it is indeed beginning to transcend them in some important ways. As consciousness evolution continues, it discloses more and more depth, or height, to this observing self. What is this observing self? How deep or high does it actually go? And the answer given by the world's greatest mystics and sages is that this observing self goes straight to God, straight to spirit, straight to the very divine. In the ultimate depths of your own awareness, you intersect infinity. This observing self is usually called the self with a capital S, or the witness, or pure presence, or pure awareness, or consciousness as such. And this self as transparent witness is a direct ray of the living divine. The ultimate I is Christ, is Buddha, is emptiness itself. Such is the startling testimony of the world's great mystics and sages.
So is this witness an emergent, something that emerges at the transpersonal stage?
Well, not exactly, because pure consciousness is not an emergent. This self or witness was present from the start as the basic form of awareness at whatever stage of growth a holon happened to be. It was present as prehension, as sensation, as impulse, as emotion, as symbols, as reason. But it becomes increasingly obvious as growth and transcendence matures. In other words, this witness, this consciousness as such, is simply the depth of any holon, the interior of any holon. As we said, depth is consciousness, and depth goes all the way down. But as depth increases, consciousness shines forth more noticeably. In humans, by the time of the centaur, this observing witness has shed its lesser identification with both the body and the mind. It has transcended and included them. And so now it can simply witness them, which is why both mind and body are experiences of an integrated self.
In other words, the self is beginning to transcend both mind and body.
Yes. There's nothing occult about any of this. We've already seen identity shift from matter to body to mind, each of which involved a decentering or a disidentifying with a lesser dimension. And by the time of the centaur, consciousness is simply continuing this process and starting to disidentify with the mind itself, which is precisely why it can witness the mind and see the mind, experience the mind. The mind is no longer merely a subject. It is starting to become an object of the observing self, the witness. And so the mystical, contemplative, and yogic traditions pick up where the mind leaves off. They pick up with the observing self as it begins to transcend the mind, as it begins to go transmental or supramental or overmental, or transrational, transegoic, transpersonal. The contemplative traditions are based on a series of experiments in awareness. What if you pursue this witness to its source? What if you inquire within, pushing deeper and deeper into the source of awareness itself? What if you push beyond or behind the mind into a depth of consciousness that is not confined to the ego or the individual self? What do you find? As a repeatable, reproducible experiment in awareness, what do you find? There is a subtle essence that pervades all reality, begins one of the most famous answers to that question. It is the reality of all that is, and the foundation of all that is. That essence is all. That essence is the real. And thou art that. In other words, this observing self eventually discloses its own source, which is spirit itself, emptiness itself. And that's why the mystics maintain that this observing self is a ray of the sun that is the radiant abyss and ultimate ground upon which the entire manifest cosmos depends. Your very self intersects the self of the cosmos at large, a supreme identity that outshines the entire manifest world, a supreme identity that undoes the knot of the separate self and buries it in splendor. So, from matter to body to mind to spirit. In each case, consciousness or the observing self sheds an exclusive identity with a lesser and shallower dimension, and opens up to deeper and higher and wider occasions, until it opens up to its own ultimate ground in spirit itself. And the stages of transpersonal growth and development are basically the stages of following this observing self to its ultimate abode, which is pure spirit, or pure emptiness, the ground, path, and fruition of the entire display.
And there are 4 stages of transpersonal growth?
Yes, that's right, but again, in a very fluid and flowing way. In looking at these higher stages, or waves of consciousness, we have a rather small pool of daring men and women, both yesterday and today, who have bucked the system, fought the average and normal, and struck out toward the new and higher spheres of awareness. In this quest, they joined with a small group or sangha of like-spirited souls and developed practices or injunctions or paradigms that would disclose these higher world spaces, injunctions or paradigms or interior experiments that would allow others to reproduce their results and therefore check and validate or reject their findings. And they left us their maps of this interior journey with a crucial proviso that simply memorizing the map will not do, any more than studying a map of the Bahamas will replace actually going there. So we take all these various maps and paths left by the great contemplative traditions, east and west, north and south, and we compare and contrast them, which demands that we practice many of them as well. This is a left-hand quadrant endeavor for participant observers, not merely a right-hand quadrant representation for academic study. Some paths are more complete than others. Some specialize in a particular level. Some leave out certain levels. Some divide particular levels into literally dozens of sub-levels. From this cross-cultural comparison, grounded in practice, we attempt to create a master template that gives a fairly comprehensive and composite map of the various higher levels of consciousness that are available to men and women. These are higher, basic levels present as potentials in all of us, but awaiting actual manifestation and growth and development. Based on the state of present research, it's fairly safe to say that there are at least four major stages of transpersonal development or evolution. These four stages I call the psychic, the subtle, the causal, and the non-dual. These are basic levels or spheres of consciousness, and so of course each of them has a different worldview, which I call, respectively, nature mysticism, deity mysticism, formless mysticism, and non-dual mysticism.
This concludes Side A.